This is the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. For today's program, we listen to a lecture on deep politics and dark events by Dr. Peter Dale Scott, which he delivered March 19th at the Hillside Club in Berkeley, California. Peter Dale Scott discloses how continuity of government communication systems were likely used by government officials during 9/11 and the JFK assassination, and how both events, among others, show patterns of deep state involvement in key historical events by U.S. intelligence agencies. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. Today's program, we'll be listening to Dr. Peter Dale Scott. We're listening to excerpts from a lecture he gave recently in Berkeley, California, on deep politics and dark events. Peter Dale Scott, former Canadian diplomat, professor of English at UC Berkeley, so one of the co-founders of the Peace and Conflict Studies program there, is author of numerous books, including American War Machine, Deep Politics, The CIA's Global Drug Connection, and The Road to Afghanistan. He is also author of The War Conspiracy, JFK, 9/11, and the Deep Politics of War. Also, The Road to 9/11, Wealth, Empire, and the Future of America. Peter Dale Scott is a longtime critic of U.S. empire. And in this discussion, in this lecture, this first excerpt we'll play for you, he explains the ideas of deep politics, deep events, and a deep state, and explains the connections he's uncovered among multiple deep events.
As most of you know, I have been writing about deep politics since 1993, when I gave the example of how the United States, after World War II, imported American mafia figures to fight communism in Italy, thereby creating a corrupted politics that was soon out of control, as bad as the influence the mafia once possessed in cities like Marseille or New York or Chicago. Since then, I have written about deep events, by which I mean mysterious events like the JFK assassination, the Watergate break-in, or 9/11, which repeatedly involve law-breaking or violence and are embedded, in fact, in deep politics. Some of these may be low-level, as when data is filched from a personal computer, or mid-level, like the murder of Karen Silkwood. But what I have called structural deep events are large enough to affect the whole fabric of society, with consequences that enlarge covert government and are subsequently covered up by systematic falsifications in media and even in internal government records. We still live in the official state of emergency that was imposed after the last great deep event, 9/11, with lasting erosion of the U.S. Constitution. In the remainder of this essay, the deep events I refer to will all be structural deep events. I have come to believe that most structural deep events are interrelated, and that the study of any one of them helps to understand others. Their interrelationship leads to two levels of history in America and two levels of historical narrative. Official or archival history, which ignores or marginalizes deep events, and a second level called deep history by its practitioners, or conspiracy theory by its critics, which incorporates them. As an example of an officially ignored or distorted deep event, I like to cite the RCMP detention in 1993 of a major al-Qaeda figure, Ali Mohammed. This happened in Vancouver Airport in Canada. Ali Mohammed was ordered released by the FBI, and this freed him to fly to Kenya, where, as the 9/11 Commission report notes, he began the planning of the 1998 U.S. embassy bombing in Nairobi. Now, you might think that was a fairly significant event worth recording. It's been recorded in the Canadian press. You will not find it reported in a straightforward way in any U.S. paper, even today, which is more than 10 years later. My study of the interrelationship between deep events has itself deepened over four decades. It began on a superficial level by noticing the overlap of apparently marginal personnel between the deep events of the Kennedy assassination and Watergate, and again between Watergate and Iran-Contra. I will never forget the New York Times front page story on June 18, 1972, the day after the Watergate break-in. There were photographs of the Watergate burglars, including one of Frank Sturgis, alias Fiorini, who I had already written about 2 years earlier in my unpublished book manuscript about the JFK assassination. Sturgis was, in fact, no nonentity. A former contract employee of the CIA, he was also well-connected to the mob-linked former casinos in Havana. It is alleged that some of the bail money that released Sturgis and the other Watergate burglars was drug money from the CIA asset-turned-drug trafficker Manuel Artima and delivered by Artima's money launderer Ramon Millan Rodriguez. After the Iran-Contra scandal went public, Millan Rodriguez was investigated by a congressional committee, but not for Watergate, but because, in support of the Contras, he had managed two Costa Rican seafood companies, Frigorificos and Ocean Hunter, that laundered drug money to support them. A more recent example would be that I already gave of Ali Mohammed, the man detained and then released by the RCMP. In the 1980s, Mohammed trained the CIA-backed Mujahideen in Afghanistan. He then trained some of those who bombed the World Trade Center in 1993, but he was excluded from the court testimony about this, and this left him free to arrange for the 1998 bombing of the U.S. Embassy in Kenya. Since 9/11, my study of structural deep events has progressed from such overlaps of personnel to three progressively deeper levels, which I call first the operational, by which I mean a common modus operandi, and then the institutional, by which I mean a shared agency of implementation, and finally the financial, by which I mean a common source of funding. I was myself startled to recognize more than a dozen common operational similarities between two events that were outwardly very dissimilar, the JFK assassination and 9/11. Among the most striking are, one, the almost instant identification of what I call the designated culprits, Lee Harvey Oswald in 63 and the 19 alleged hijackers in 2001, all named and identified before the last of the four planes had hit the ground. And then secondly, the hidden intelligence backgrounds of all of these designated culprits, and three, the protection by the FBI and CIA of the designated culprits, both in 63 and in 93, the protection by the FBI agents and CIA agents of the designated culprits in the weeks before the events to make sure that they would not be placed under surveillance on the day in question, or worse still, taken off the streets, in which case they couldn't have played the role that they did. I've written at some length about this in my 2008 book, The War Conspiracy, but will say a few words here just about that last item of protection. Both the JFK assassination and 9/11 were facilitated by the way the CIA and FBI manipulated their files about designated culprits in each event. The alleged hijackers Khalid al-Mikhtar and Nawif al-Hazmi in the case of 9/11. Part of this facilitation was the decision on October 9th, 1963, of an FBI agent, Marvin Gisling, to remove Lee Harvey Oswald from the FBI watch list for surveillance. This was a very odd thing to do because Oswald had just begun acting politically for the first time since his return from Russia. He had been arrested in New Orleans in August, and then he was reported to have traveled to Mexico in September. Gisling's behavior fits very neatly with the CIA's culpable withholding from the FBI in that same month of October. This is just weeks before the assassination. Information that Oswald had allegedly met in Mexico City with a suspected KGB agent, actually assassination expert, some said, Valery Kostikov. I don't myself believe it happened, but there it was, reported to CIA headquarters. They didn't transmit it to the FBI.
That is the voice of Dr. Peter Dale Scott. That was from a talk that he delivered March 19th at the Hillside Club here in Berkeley, California. The event was co-sponsored by KPFA and Project Censored, and the host for the evening was Pacifica Radio Guns and Butter radio host Bonnie Faulkner. So it was a wonderful evening in mid-March where we got to hear some very controversial but well-sourced information by Peter Dale Scott on deep politics and dark events. Peter?
This is a amazing and wonderful lecture that hits deep. And we keep using the word deep politics and dark events, but it certainly gives us a clear understanding of the continuity of events that have happened in modern history. If we look at JFK assassination and we look at 9/11, Peter Dale Scott is saying there are comparative behavior patterns that are ongoing here. An immediate identification of the bad guys. The fact that these people were all involved in the intelligence agencies in some way. And then protection by, before and after, by the FBI and the CIA. These are very strong accusations, well documented.
That's right, Peter. And Peter Dale Scott, of course, author of so many great books. This talk is the culmination of four decades of his research. Of course, people that are familiar with Peter Dale Scott know his books, American War Machine, The Road to 9/11, his longtime research regarding the drug trade and covert operations, continuity of government. These are all concepts here that Peter Dale Scott has been working on for a very long time. Of course, we've interviewed Peter Dale Scott on the Project Censored show several times. One of his recent articles, The State, the Deep State, and Wall Street Overworld, Scott calls attention to how journalists Dana Priest and William Arkin are actually talking about, quote, two governments. The one its citizens were familiar with operated more or less in the open. The other, a parallel top-secret government whose parts had mushroomed in less than a decade into a gigantic, sprawling universe of its own, visible to only a carefully vetted cadre and its entirety, visible only to God. So Peter Dale Scott has been talking about the deep events, deep politics, deep state activities for a long time. Some of this has crept over into some more mainstream writing. Bill Moyers at PBS has covered the issue for some time, but Peter Dale Scott really masters the information. And what we're going to do right now is we're going to segue into our Project Censored Validated Independent News story, this one on the Ukraine.
For Project Censored, I'm Alexandria McDowell with today's Validated Independent News story. As tensions between superpowers grow due to the crisis in Ukraine, U.S. media outlets fan the flames of conflict with a full front of propaganda in order to vilify Russia and its leader, Vladimir Putin. Stephen Cohen with The Nation provides coverage of everything from seemingly third-world living conditions to high terror alert tension during the recent Olympics to the bullying from the cruel Putin regime, including its strong-arming of the Ukraine. The U.S. corporate media has painted Putin and Russia as public enemy number one, reviving Cold War rhetoric and out-of-date tactics. For example, even before the Sochi Olympics began, the New York Times headlines read, "Terrorism and tension, not sports and joy." Almost unanimously, U.S. reports claim that President Putin also had squandered a record $51 billion on the Olympics, proving his regime to be corrupt. As for the Ukraine crisis, Putin and Russia are depicted as militant bullies rather than a leader in a country trying to maintain control over strategic oil assets to maintain the country's sphere of influence. Also identified by Cohen, the corporate media's coverage of Putin and the Ukraine is part of a larger pattern of bias. He describes the positive U.S. press coverage enjoyed by President Boris Yeltsin in the 1990s at a time when, quote, the U.S. media adopted Washington's narrative that almost everything President Boris Yeltsin did was a transition from communism to democracy, and thus in America's best interest, end quote. Whereas the U.S. media presented Yeltsin as pursuing legitimate politics and national interests, the frame that the U.S. media now uses to portray Putin and Russia is that it's Putin's Russia, and that it has no legitimate politics and national interests, even on its own borders, as in the Ukraine. Assessing corporate news coverage of the Ukraine crisis, Cohen concludes that, quote, American media on Russia today are less objective, less balanced, more conformist, and scarcely less ideological than when they covered the Soviet Russia during the Cold War, end quote. The topic of Russia and the Ukraine will not be going away anytime soon. However, I do wonder if the real story involving Russia and the Ukraine will ever surface in today's corporate-run media. This has been Alexandria McDowell with Project Censored. This underreported news story was researched by Brian Brennan with Diablo Valley College and evaluated by faculty Mickey Huff, also with Diablo Valley College, as part of Project Censored's Validated Independent News Program. For more Validated Independent News stories, go to projectcensored.org and follow the link for Validated News.
Government had a secret operation, massacring villages, killing millions, secretly bombing an entire nation. They wiretapped a hotel room. They got caught and the government was deposed because of secret documents Daniel Ellsberg exposed. One government came down, and to prevent a repetition of this fact, the next government passed the Freedom of Information Act. Each administration since then hoped it would go away, and then they finally seized the chance on a September day. They passed the Patriot Act before a single congressman had read it, but don't ask the executive how they interpret it, because that itself is secret, never to be revealed, just like their secret prisons and all the torture sessions they concealed. Then they formed the prison program so they wouldn't even have to ask compliant corporations to assist them in the task of collecting information. Every email you ever wrote, every book you ever read, every call you ever made, everything you ever said. I looked into a prism. What did I see? A police state looking back at me. The secret government men lie.
That's the music of David Rovix. The song is called Prism. Definitely overlaps with our subject of the day, deep politics and dark events. We're playing excerpts from a recent talk by Dr. Peter Dale Scott. He delivered this talk March 19th at the Hillside Club in Berkeley, California. Peter Dale Scott has told us about some of the individuals who've been involved in more than one deep event. Now, in this next excerpt, he tells us about another kind of common thread, the federal government's National Communications System, or NCS, a system originally designed to keep the government running in the event of a nuclear war, and the ways it's been used by some of the players in the deep events to keep their activities undetected.
On the institutional level, it is striking to me that in every structural deep event since the JFK assassination, we find some role played by the National Communications System, that's NCS with capitals, the shadow network created to ensure continuity of government, or COG, in the event of an atomic attack. It was originally developed, very extreme measures developed originally to deal with an atomic attack, but then changed under Ronald Reagan to deal with any emergency, which is why they were actually implemented on 9/11. The NCS was formally established by a JFK presidential memorandum in August 1963. By 1969, at least 175 million had been spent to increase the survivability of national communications resources in a nuclear attack. In June 1979, the system was tested under Carter in the first known instance of the COG exercise Global Shield. By the Reagan era, the NCS had mushroomed into an $8 billion communications and logistics program for an alternative emergency communications network. This alternative network played a central role in Iran-Contra when Oliver North, arranging for the arms shipments to Iran that eventually cost him his job, used the nation's top secret COG communications network. North's network, known as Flashboard, excluded, this is a quote now, excluded other bureaucrats with opposing viewpoints and had its own worldwide anti-terrorist computer network by which members could communicate exclusively with each other and their collaborators abroad. And this is how, for example, the ambassador in Portugal never knew that arms were being transloaded in Portugal on their way to Iran. North was also actively developing plans, which originated with Hoover, for emergency detentions on a large scale. He planned it, and after 9/11, those plans, too, were implemented. So, before North was James McCord, famous for having participated in the 1972 burglary that precipitated the Watergate crisis. McCord was a member of a small Air Force reserve unit in Washington attached to the Office of Emergency Preparedness, assigned to draw up lists of radicals, that's us, I think, and to develop contingency plans for censorship of the news, media, and U.S. mail in time of war. His unit was part of the Wartime Information Security Program, WISP, which had responsible for activating, quote, contingency plans for imposing censorship on the press, the mails, and all telecommunications, and preventive detention of civilian security risks who would be placed in military camps. They were planning all that back in 1972. Since I first advanced the hypothesis that the COG communications network was involved in all our structural deep events, further revelations have corroborated it. For example, John Dean, perhaps the central Watergate figure, had supervised COG activity when he was in the Pentagon. And an Army Reserve officer, Norman Katz, revealed just last October that because of his work in COG communications, he was summoned to Washington in November 63 in connection with President Kennedy's trip to Dallas. But the most striking function of the COG network in a deep event is 9/11. In The Road to 9/11, I advance reasons to believe that Cheney and Rumsfeld, during the short period that morning when they were inexplicably not in their command posts and the nation was under attack, they were instead using the COG network to finalize emergency measures, soon to include the first ever implementation that same morning of COG measures. I find this the more remarkable because for two decades before 9/11, Rumsfeld and Cheney had also both been part of a small, very small secret committee planning, even when neither man was in the government, planning for extreme COG measures, including, allegedly, suspension of the U.S. Constitution. Some of you or maybe old enough to remember that Oliver North was asked about this planning for suspension of the U.S. Constitution in the Iran-Contra hearings, and the chairman banged his gavel. He was a Democrat, by the way, banged his gavel and said, we can't go into that in public session. That brings us to the American deep state. In 2007, because of this institutional continuity to deep events, and I wrote in The Road to the 9/11 of an American deep state. Since then, the term deep state has gone viral, with 706,000 hits now on Google. About 4 months ago, it was less than half that. 1 week ago, I published a major essay on the deep state that was 4 months in the making. And 1 week before that, there was another essay on the deep state published by a former Republican aide on Capitol Hill, Mike Lofgren. An excellent essay, by the way. Mike Lofgren's definition of the deep state will suit us here. And this is his definition. There is the visible government situated around the mall in Washington, and then there is another, more shadowy, more indefinable government that is not explained in Civics 101. The subsurface part of the iceberg I shall call the deep state, which operates according to its own compass heading, regardless of who is formally in power. And that's the key thing, that we elect Democrats, we elect Republicans. It makes no difference to this secret planning for COG measures, which continue, and other things, of course. I count, by the way, the warrantless surveillance that we're all hearing about now from Snowden and Glenn Greenwald. I count that part of the COG measures, though I can't prove it. It was described as being part of it way back in 1987 when this whole problem first emerged. Anyway, like myself, Lofgren suggests an ambiguous symbiosis between two different aspects of the American deep state. The first, the beltway agencies of the shadow government, like the CIA and NSA, which have been instituted by the public state and now overshadow it, but also including private corporations like Booz Allen Hamilton, they, you remember, were Snowden's employers, and also SAIC, which I wrote about in the war conspiracy as having engineered the U.S. or helped engineer the U.S. entry into Iraq in 2003. 70% of intelligence budgets are now outsourced to private companies like Booz Allen Hamilton, which, by the way, is owned by the Carlyle Group, and SAIC. And then the second aspect is the much older power of Wall Street. By Wall Street, I refer chiefly to the powerful banks and law firms located there, but also to the cartels and other corporate alliances established there, as well as to Wall Street's own think tank, the Council on Foreign Relations. In the 1950s, Wall Street was a dominating complex. It included not just banks and law firms, but also the oil majors whose cartel arrangements were successfully defended against the U.S. government by the Wall Street law firms Sullivan and Cromwell, home to the Dulles brothers. This larger complex is what I mean by the Wall Street overworld. Lofgren's inclusion of Wall Street conforms with Franklin Roosevelt's observation in 1933 to his friend Colonel E.M. House that, and this is a quote from Roosevelt, "The real truth is, as you and I know, that a financial element in the larger centers has owned the government ever since the days of Andrew Jackson."
That's the voice of Peter Dale Scott from a talk that he gave in Berkeley in March at the Hillside Club. The talk was on deep politics and dark events.
He's talking about the continuity of government. This goes back to the beginnings of the Cold War, when we were really facing the possibility and planning for nuclear exchanges with the Soviet Union. And in that case, we were going to allow government to continue sort of underground. So we built out this system called the continuity of government that had these communication systems. Now we know from Peter Dale's talk that those were used during the Kennedy assassination. They were used during 9/11 for government officials to talk to each other. This is his indication of the kinds of deep state activities that were ongoing. And that these need to be reviewed and researched and validated by the American public. We need to know this.
We're listening to excerpts of a speech from this past March by Peter Dale Scott. He's written about issues from JFK assassination to the world drug trade, the September 11th attacks. In this next segment, we want to share with you, Peter Dale Scott looks at whether the elected government can control elements like the CIA by way of budgetary authority, and notes that the CIA has historically been adept at circumventing the official budget process to obtain funding from overseas.
Most of this talk tonight is on the level of what I call the financial overlap of structural deep events. So I have a section here on the CIA and an old cliche from political science, the power of the purse. Conventional political analysis claims that CIA is limited by the constitutional system of checks and balances in which Congress controls by its power of the purse. And here is a standard quotation. I could have found hundreds of them. And this is a quote. Congress maintains the power of the purse, which gives lawmakers the ability to defund specific programs the federal agency holds dear. But the CIA maintains the documents and information Congress needs to see to effectively conduct oversight in the first place. So you're supposed to have checks, mutual checks and balances. The problem with this is that since its outset, the CIA has always had access to large amounts of off-the-books or offshore funds to support its activities, funds which do not come from Congress. Indeed, the power of the purse has usually worked in the opposite direction. Since those in control of deep state offshore funds supporting CIA activities have for decades also funded members of Congress and of the executive, not vice versa, the last six decades provide a coherent and continuous picture of historical direction being provided by this deep state power of the purse, trumping and sometimes reversing the conventional state. Let us quickly resume some, only some, of the CIA's sources of offshore and off-the-books funding for its activities. Let's take the very first CIA covert operation in 1948 to support the right-wing parties in the Italian election. And there they used, quote, over $10 million in captured Axis funds to influence the election, close quote. The fundraising had actually begun at the wealthy Brook Club in New York. But Alan Dulles, who was then still a Wall Street lawyer, persuaded Washington, which at first had preferred a private funding campaign, to authorize the operation through the National Security Council and the CIA. So you see which was more powerful here, New York or Washington. It was New York that got its way, Alan Dulles. Dulles, together with George Kennan and James Forrestal, then found a way to provide a legal source for all off-the-books CIA funding in Europe, under the cover of the Marshall Plan. The three men, and here's a quote, not me, helped devise a secret codicil to the Marshall Plan that gave the CIA the capability to conduct political warfare. It let the agency skim millions of dollars from the plan. So this was money that originally came from Congress, but it was not controlled by Congress. It went into a special fund, and the CIA spent it as it saw fit, and that's how you had support for Corsican drug-running gangsters in Marseille and in other mafia figures in Sicily, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. At the time of the Marshall Plan slush fund in Europe, the CIA also took steps which resulted in drug money to support anti-communist armies in the Far East. In my book, American War Machine, I tell how the CIA, using former OSS operative Paul Helliwell, created two proprietary firms as infrastructure for a KMT army in Burma, an army which quickly became involved in managing and developing the opium traffic there, and I could add, turning what we called the Golden Triangle into, for two decades, the leading source of opium in the world, which it had not been before. The two firms were Sea Supply, Inc. in Bangkok and CAT, Inc., later Air America, in Taiwan. Significantly, the CIA split ownership of CAT, Inc.'s planes with KMT bankers in Taiwan, and this allowed the CIA to deny responsibility for the flights when CAT planes, having delivered arms from Sea Supply to the opium-growing army, then returned to Taiwan with opium for the KMT. In 1953, the CIA officially severed its connection to the KMT army. Thereafter, its proprietary firm, Sea Supply, Inc., supplied arms for a CIA-led paramilitary force in Thailand called PARU that was also financed, at least in part, by the drug traffic. And we know this from an oral history with the CIA agent who ran it, who freely confessed it. Profits from Thailand also filtered back, in part through the same Paul Helliwell, as donations to members from both parties in Congress. Thai dictator Pao Srianon, a drug trafficker who was then alleged to be the richest man in the world, hired lawyer Paul Helliwell as a lobbyist, in addition to former OSS chief William Donovan, who had been the U.S. ambassador in Thailand. Donovan and Helliwell divided the Congress between them, with Donovan assuming responsibility for the Republicans and Helliwell taking the Democrats. I like that word, taking.
That's the voice of Dr. Peter Dale Scott from a recent lecture he gave in Berkeley, California at the Hillside Club. The lecture was titled Deep Politics and Dark Events. Peter Dale Scott talks about deep politics and dark events. He has historically talked about JFK, 9/11, the international drug trade, as recent events seem to beg for this type of analysis. Peter, you and I, Nolan Higdon, we've recently been looking at the issue of the Ukraine. We were working on a piece for a book coming out by Stephen Lenman, and we've been working on deep politics and deep state analysis, and you have worked out a five-part sort of plan, or five ways in which deep state activities can occur or deep political events can occur via regime change. And in this case, we're looking at Ukraine, but there's also several other states that fit into this model. Tell us about this, Peter.
Well, certainly Peter Dale's understanding of deep state political activities and deep events leads us to really carefully look at the regime changes, the attempts that have been made or ongoing, and the successes that have occurred from the U.S.-NATO perspective. So deep state intelligence apparatuses engage in systematic undermining of regimes that have been targeted for change to governments that are more acceptable to international capital. I mean, there's a straightforward way of saying that. So Yugoslavia, Libya, Syria, the Ukraine have all been undermined, and certainly in attempts in Venezuela to change governments there and that are more acceptable to the neoliberal global economics, International Monetary Fund, the World Bank. There are patterns now that were quite evident. So we see that in each of these cases, a long-term external funding of opposition parties occurs. Special projects in democracy building, counterintelligence agencies, bribing of officials, infiltrating of regime bureaucracies, USAID and the International Development, USAID and the National Endowment for Democracy are often working in cooperation with private corporations, intelligence agencies to undermine. And then U.S. ambassadors or the CIA people in country help coordinate these activities.
And that's not to say that there aren't pro-democracy movements inside these countries. And, Peter, that's not to suggest that there are not pro-democracy movements or people's movements in these countries that would maybe like some other type of changes or have their voice heard and recognized, particularly in some of the more oppressive state examples. But there's no denying that there is significant U.S., NATO, even NGO influence in funding certain factions in the society that have a desired outcome that really doesn't match necessarily what some of the pro-democracy movements may want.
We're talking billions of dollars here.
$5 billion
in the Ukraine alone.
In
Ukraine alone, exactly. So we know that in Syria and Libya, that billions were used well in advance. And then these funds go to opposition groups to organize public events, mass rallies, demonstrations against the regime, and that always ends up with some sort of conflict between police and demonstrators, and then the corporate media. Worldwide will be trumpeting this idea of a loss of humanitarian rights, human rights are being violated, and that. We now know that efforts to create violent incidences can occur where external forces, mercenaries, or events like the use of sarin gas in Syria, which has now been proven the Syrian government didn't do that, but it was set up to make it look like they did, or where innocent civilians are assassinated by snipers. This happened in Venezuela. It happened in Syria. It's happened in Libya and in Ukraine. These are mercenaries hired externally to come in and kill people innocently to create a false flag event that would be blamed on the regime.
And this is important to note. This is exactly the deep state, deep politic, dark event type analysis and example, series of examples that really should be part of the discourse and the dialogue surrounding this, particularly in the U.S. and in the EU. Of course, we know Victoria Nuland's infamous statement about what she thought of the EU. We can't say that on the air without getting fined, however. But there's definitely clear indication from leaked cables that shows the U.S. strong-arming the European Union, berating it for not acting quickly enough in Ukraine. And then there's the other whole angle here, Peter, that's involved, and that's the propaganda angle. You just mentioned the false flag series. But, it's not just to the corporate media, but it's also state-run media that are very viciously propagandizing. It's almost like a Cold War 2.0 kind of rhetoric and mythology that's going on here.
There's a calling in the media for humanitarian intervention. With that is often economic and trade sanctions, the cutting off of the regime's access to international banking and credit. Then there will be UN resolutions, maybe even indictments by the International Criminal Court of some of the people inside the regime. So there's a pattern. If we look at these different countries, these are not isolated events. The same sorts of behaviors are happening. And then ultimately, as a regime collapses, either from a military coup or opposition forces take command of the government, as they did in Ukraine, and or, if necessary, the United Nations U.S. NATO will be doing military actions, no-fly zones, bombings, invasions, etc.
Well, this is all justified under the Orwellian phrase humanitarian intervention, which is, again, actually more of the – I mean, it's we're talking about military occupation, sanctions that harm the general population, and sometimes just leave the regime intact. The way that the corporate media and state-run media have been depicting the situation is it's almost cartoonish in its simplicity about Putin, the great aggressor, and so forth. And that's not to suggest certainly that Putin is some kind of angel in the mix here, or that Putin is not one of the global players that is also incredibly problematic. But isn't that exactly what makes this such a dangerous situation? In terms of how it could escalate, given that the Russians obviously know what the U.S.-NATO alliance motives are.
It's beyond the war on terror. It's beyond just humanitarian intervention. That isn't justifiable in Ukraine or in Iran, for that matter. We're talking Cold War threats. We're talking about nuclear weapon exchanges. We have people in Congress calling for the bombing of Iran. So those are very dangerous scenarios.
And I think it's also a great example, these leaked cables and the information that we have about the Undersecretary of State, Victoria Nuland. It clearly shows what Peter Dale Scott means when he talks about the deep state, or when Mike Lofgren defines the deep state, or Tom Hayden has also defined it. It's two entities. There is this sort of surface, this necessary illusion of democratic institutional participation. But then underneath is the shadowy world, the shadow government of who really calls the shots, as Peter Dale Scott calls them, the Wall Street overlords, the drug traders and cartels, the munitions suppliers. And there's a long history of this. Peter Dale Scott goes back and looks at it from World War I, World War II, the emerging Cold War. Here we are in the 21st century in ever need of Peter Dale Scott's type of analysis, particularly what's unfolding now in Europe.
Well, as we look at these histories, I mean, whether it's Iran, Iraq, Venezuela, Yugoslavia, even El Salvador, Libya, Syria, these are all Ukraine, all places where the U.S. NATO interests have undermined the regimes that were in place, the governments in place, to try to put into place more cooperative governments that are going to support neoliberal policies, are going to support austerity programs against their populations. And these are deliberate attempts to enrich the richest people in the world, to enrich the transnational corporate class.
That's really what it comes back to. And, of course, that's the focus of our essay that will be coming out in a forthcoming book edited by Stephen Lenman. You've been listening to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. Special thanks to our producer, Anthony Fest, Kirsten Thomas at the controls. Today's program was Peter Dale Scott, Deep Politics, Dark Events. The Project Censored Show airs on over a dozen stations around the U.S. Archives can be found online at projectcensored.org. Please follow and like us on Facebook. The Project Censored Show originates at KPFA Studios in Berkeley, California. Thanks so much for joining us. See you next time.